also I want to thank the organisers for this meeting. I'm enjoying it immensely and learning a lot. And also thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak. I'm going to tell you about an approach to the problem of quantum gravity that I've been working on for quite a while now. And I know that it will be new to some of you, so I will give some kind of introduction, motivation to this approach. And then for those of you who have already met causal sets before, that I'll then describe some more recent work about actions for causal sets. So at the boundary between quantum theory and gravity, we find physics at its least unified. The disjunction between our understanding of space-time and our understanding of matter is very conceptual, and the lack of unity there is of a higher order of magnitude than anything we've encountered yet in fundamental physics. And yet I also want to point out that it's where physics is at its most unified, because we have a body of knowledge called black hole thermodynamics, which brings together gravity, quantum theory, and thermodynamics in a beautiful whole. And so there's a sort of dichotomy at this quantum gravity boundary. Physics is very disunified, and yet it's the most unified that it's ever been. So in working towards quantum gravity, most people believe that science will have to make what Jacobson and Parentani call the leap to a new conception. So to arrive at a theory of quantum gravity, we must make a creative leap from a position that's grounded in current knowledge, but we must go beyond that current knowledge and make new hypotheses. So identifying that grounded position is itself a creative act, so that at any stage in the development towards a new theory, there'll be diverse opinions about which aspects of our current best theories will survive the revolution, and which will turn out to be what Jim Hartle calls excess baggage. So the causal set approach claims that certain aspects of general relativity and quantum theory will have direct counterparts in quantum gravity. And they are the space-time causal order from general relativity and the path integral from quantum theory. And it makes one main new hypothesis about the nature of the physical world, which is fundamental discreteness of space-time. So I'll flesh out these three components of causal set theory and give you some motivation, at least my own personal motivation, some of my own personal motivation, for considering these as the bare-bones conceptual framework of an approach to quantum gravity. So space-time in general relativity has a causal order. So any two events in space-time are either space-like separated, and there's no causal curve that links them, or one can be in the causal past of another if there is some causal curve from the point in the past to the point in the future. So that causal order is fundamental to understanding the theory. And just as an example of that, the ubiquitous use of Penrose diagrams indicates that we really are usually thinking about causal structure when we're thinking about general relativity and what's happening in general relativity. Another example that I want to emphasize is that the epitome of general relativity is a black hole. And our understanding of a black hole is in four-dimensional space-time causal terms. In fact, the very definition of a black hole is black hole horizon is of the boundary of the causal past of future null infinity. There is prima facie evidence that black hole thermodynamics is due to the causal nature of the horizon. And in particular, the generalized second law is evidence for that. So Hawking's area theorem is proved using global causal analysis. There are violations of the generalized second law if you don't have relativistic causal structure. This work by Elling, Foster, Jacobson, and Wall. And Aaron Wall has provided evidence that you can violate the generalized second law semi-classically, so in other words, when you consider quantized fields in a semi-classical space-time, or apparent or dynamical horizons, whereas you can prove the generalized second law semi-classically for causal horizons. And finally, there's a proof scheme for the generalized second law in full quantum gravity, which is due to Sorkin, and it fundamentally uses the notion of causality. And then there's also this beautiful conjecture or proposal by Jacobson and Parentani that all causal horizons obey the laws of thermodynamics, where a causal horizon is now a more general concept. It's the boundary of the causal past of some future infinite time-like curve. For example, black hole horizons, de Sitter horizons, and Rindler horizons are all examples of causal horizons. And Jacobson and Parentani suggest that we should think fundamentally about causal horizon entropy and not black hole entropy. So causal structure is also a unifying concept. And the causal structure, this information about which events are to the causal past or future of which other events, which ones are space-like, together, that information unifies within itself the topology, including the dimension of the Lorentzian space-time, the differentiable structure, and in four dimensions, 9/10 of the metric. And these ideas that causal structure is the most fundamental property that a Lorentzian space-time has have been around from very early on in the development of relativity. And here are some of the names associated with that, this result. So I want to point out that in the case of strongly causal spacetimes are ones in which the local causal structure agrees with the global causal structure. They're compatible with each other. In strongly causal spacetimes, this result that the causal order gives you topology, differentiable structure, and 9/10 of the metric has been known for a long time. And it follows from theorems from the classical, what one might call the classical period of general relativity. And in particular, the result by Hawking that the differentiable structure follows from, if you know the local light cone structure of a space-time, then you know the differentiable structure. If you know that, then there's half a page in Hawking and Ellis which shows that you can get 9/10 of the metric. Now, I just want to point out that very recently, Parikar and Sumiti Surya have proved that this result can be actually generalized further to a distinguishing spacetime. That's a spacetime which has causal properties which are slightly more general than strongly causal spacetimes. And they finally put the final piece into the result that you can extend this strongly causal spacetime result to all distinguishing spacetimes. So space-time in general relativity, with some causality conditions on the space-time, is almost causal order. The only thing that you're missing is 1/10 of the metric, which you can identify as the conformal factor. So we know that when you do a conformal transformation, the causal structure doesn't the space-time doesn't change. So you know you can't fix the overall local scale by knowing the causal structure. But you get everything else, absolutely everything else about the metric. So the missing tenth of this of the space-time geometry that you don't get by causal structure is local physical scale. And as we heard in the talk yesterday, that's very similar to the motivations behind twister theory, where you need to fix the local physical scale by choosing this twister at infinity. Causal sets arise as the marriage between causal structure and atomicity, or fundamental discreteness. So it's widely expected that space-time will not be well described by a Lorentzian manifold at close to Planckian scales. And most strikingly, semi-classical explorations of black hole entropy suggest that physics needs a physical cutoff at around that scale in order to be consistent with the known value for the black hole entropy. This point has been emphasized particularly by Raphael Sorkin. Now, fundamental space-time atomicity is one way to realize this expectation that the differentiable manifold structure of space-time breaks down at the Planck scale. It's perhaps the simplest way to realize it. It just says there is no structure smaller than the Planck scale. And it happens to be exactly what one needs if one is drawn, for perhaps more philosophical reasons, to conceive of space-time as pure causal order. So continuum space-time can't be pure causal order because you're missing scale, you're missing physical scale. But if you have an atomic space-time, then this atomicity does the job of providing this missing physical scale because we can count. And so we can associate the number, just the number of space-time atoms in a particular portion of the space-time to the volume of the space-time volume in some fundamental units. And so a causal set is a discrete or atomic causal order. And this slogan is the fundamental slogan of causal set theory. It says order, in other words, causal order, plus number equals geometry. So this provides the causal structure, this provides local scale, and it will give you, together will give you geometry. So here's a briefly the definition of a causal set. So a causal set is just a set with an order relation precedes, which is transitive. If x precedes y and y precedes z, then x precedes z. It's acyclic, so if x precedes y and y precedes x, then x is equal to y. There are no loops in this order. And it's locally finite, so that if you have any two ordered elements, x and z, then the number of elements y that lies between x and z in the order is finite. So the first two axioms are the axioms of a partial order. And the third axiom is what makes the set discrete. The elements of this causal set are the atoms of space-time, and the hypothesis of causal set theory is that the deep structure of space-time is a causal set. Now, at macroscopic scales, this order, the fundamental order of the causal set, gives rise to the space-time causal order, and the number of elements gives rise to the space-time volume, and together the causal order and the volume will give you the geometry. This was proposed independently by Etouft, by Mierheim, Bombelli, Lee, Meyer, and Sorkin, and has been championed particularly by Raphael Sorkin since then. So here's an example of a causal set, and it's one that's well approximated by 2D Minkowski space. So the causal set is just the elements of the causal set are the black dots. So in a sense, it's a graph. It's an acyclic, transitive, directed graph. And what I've drawn here is the Hasse diagram. So in other words, I've drawn a blue line between two elements if those elements are related in the order and the order is going upwards. So the past is down here and the future is down there. So there's a direction which is just given by the direction of the order is just represented by the direction of going up the page. So I've drawn a line between two elements which are related in the order, but they have to be related in a nearest neighbor way. So there mustn't be any element which is which is in between them. So this element here is causally related to this one there. This is in the past of this one. But I haven't drawn a line between them because there's actually a chain of so-called links, these blue lines, these irreducible relations, between this one and that one. So this is a Hasse diagram representation of a causal set. I've embedded this causal set in two-dimensional Minkowski space-time, and the embedding satisfies the property that the number of causal set elements in any particular region is proportional in some units to the area of that region. So this is the simplest possible example of a causal set that I can show you. And it's Lorentz invariant. So the order relation between the elements is a Lorentz invariant concept. And space-time area is also a Lorentz invariant concept. So this causal set is a Lorentz invariant discrete space-time to which this Minkowski space-time is, by hypothesis, a good approximation. The causal set is relational in the sense that the causal set elements are all identical. I mean, they have no structure. Their only property is that there's just when you have a collection of them, the only property is that they have in and of themselves is the number. So a causal set element just has the property that there's one of it. But they acquire individuality through their causal relation, through their relations with the rest of the causal set. So this element is different from this one because of all its causal relations to the rest of the causal set, and it's different from the causal relations of this one to the rest of the causal set. It's very austere, so you could represent this in your computer program, in your computer, just by a list of elements and then a list of these links, for example. That would completely characterize the causal set. It's just the information that's encoded in the links is just one bit of information. There's no length associated with any of these blue links in the causal set itself. And it's, you can see, highly non-local. So there are links between elements. Well, I think there's actually a link between this element here and this element there, which you can't really see in the diagram. But this element is roughly one fundamental unit of proper time from this one. And there's nothing causally in between this one and this one. So this is an irreducible relation. And it's just as nearest neighbor as this one. So it's just that I've chosen to embed the causal set in this particular frame, that this one looks long. It's not really in the fundamental Lorentzian geometry. It's not long at all. And this one looks short, but they're actually of the same order of magnitude of proper length. So on Planckian scales, the hypothesis is that this is what Minkowski space actually is. It's a causal set like this. And a causal set then unifies manifold and metric. So in the continuum, you have a manifold and then you have a metric on it. So there's a sort of two-level construction that you have to do in order to get describe a Lorentzian manifold. But a causal set is just one thing. It's just C, this set of elements with these relations. So it carries within itself its own geometry. You don't need to impose geometry on top of it. It carries its own geometry with it. Okay, so what's the evidence that Lorentzian geometry is encoded in Lorentzian geometry can be encoded in such an austere and simple thing as a causal set? Well, the theorem that I told you about, that causal order plus volume information gives you the geometry in the continuum is strong motivation for believing this conjecture. But we have other evidence. And the technique that we use is called sprinkling. And I need to explain this to you because I'm going to use this idea in the rest of the talk. So a causal set is well approximated by some Lorentzian manifold if that causal set could have arisen by a process of sprinkling into that manifold. So what sprinkling is, a Poisson process of choosing points at random from the Lorentzian geometry, and then endowing those points with the order that they inherit from the space-time causal order. Then you throw the space-time away, and you're left with a causal set, and the Lorentzian geometry is hypothesized to be a good approximation to this causal set that you produced from it. So we have evidence for this, that such causal sets do encode Lorentzian geometry. You can get back the Lorentzian geometry at scales larger than the density of your sprinkling from the causal set itself. And that includes reading out of dimension, time-like geodesic distance, spatial topology, and one relatively new thing, which is the Whiteman function of a free scalar field in two and four dimensions. This is a two-dimensional Whiteman function of a massive scalar field. The blue fuzz is data from the causal set, so you can produce this function directly from the causal set, the sprinkled causal set, with no continuum information at all. Produce this blue fuzz, and the continuum value of the this is the imaginary part of the actually of the Feynman propagator, which encodes the Wyman function. So the red line is just the is the continuum Wyman function. In curved space, we have much less evidence, but now we have a scalar curvature estimator, and also estimators of certain components of the Ricci tensor, and these really remain to be tested. Okay, so that's kinematics, the kinematics of causal sets. What about quantum dynamics? So I said that the quantum theory of causal sets is based on the path integral, and from this picture, you can kind of see why. A structure like this is inimical to a canonical approach. The non-locality of these nearest neighbor links makes it extremely difficult. Well, for me, I can't conceive of how to approach this a quantum theory of an object like this in a canonical framework. So we're going to use the path integral approach to quantum gravity. And here's the kind of cartoon statement of what that means in the continuum. It's a sum over manifolds, perhaps, or maybe the manifold is fixed, but we don't know. And then an integral over geometries. And however, this, of course, is just what Renata Lowell calls a statement of intent. So I love that phrase, I say it all the time. So this is just a statement of intent. We intend to do this, something like this path integral over geometries. And the hypothesis of the causal set approach is that the fundamental meaning of this statement of intent is this. So it's a, here I fixed the space-time volume. In this partition function, I fixed the number of elements because of the correspondence between number of elements and space-time volume. Fix the number of elements, and then you just sum weight, e to the is, of C over all causal sets C of that fixed cardinality. And that's a finite sum. So one advantage of this approach is that this is just, it's literally a finite sum, so it exists. So that's there's no worry about it being being somehow ill-defined. Now, if the causal sets that dominate this sum are, perhaps upon some coarse graining, manifold-like, in other words, if they are like that sprinkling into Minkowski space that I showed you, or sprinkling into some nice, large, smooth space-time, then there'll be a continuum regime. There will be a regime in which continuum physics has a chance of emerging. Otherwise, if that's not the case, if this is not this sum is not dominated by manifold-like causal sets, then this fails. So it's perhaps one of the most important, the most important problem to settle the question of whether a continuum regime arises from quantum causal set theory. And here we see what I've called the primal struggle between entropy and action. And in causal set theory, it takes a very precise form. So this is a sum over all causal sets of a fixed cardinality. And most of those causal sets look nothing like manifolds. In fact, the vast majority of them look nothing like manifolds. I'll show you an example of one of these very numerous non-manifold-like causal sets in a minute. So there's huge numbers of junk and garbage in this sum. And it's supposed to be counter. And if they dominate, then there'll be no continuum regime. However, that entropy has to be counteracted by the dynamics, dynamics in the form of the action. So there's a struggle between all these non-manifold-like causal sets, which are threatening to swamp the partition function, and the action, which has to do the job of suppressing them. And I've learned to think in this way, particularly by listening to Jan Ambion, Renata Lowell, and Raphael Sorkin. Okay. So an entropic disaster looms, as I said, in the following way. The number of, in more detail, in the following way. The number of causal sets of cardinality n grows like 2 to the n squared on 4. However, the number of what I call Kleitman-Rostad or KR orders of cardinality n also grows like 2 to the n squared on 4. So they are actually the vast majority of all causal sets of size cardinality n as n gets big. So the fraction of KR orders in this collection of causal sets of cardinality n tends to 1 as n tends to infinity. What are these KR orders? They have this peculiar structure. They are three level orders. There's a bottom layer of roughly a quarter n over 4 elements. There's a middle layer of roughly n over 2 elements. And there's a top layer of roughly n over 2 elements. And there are links, many more links than the ones I've just drawn here as the representatives, between the middle layer and the bottom layer, and between the bottom layer and the top layer. So this is the causal set analog of one aspect of the cosmological constant problem, the fact that the cosmological constant wants to be 1 in natural units. If it were 1, then there would be curvature on Planckian scales. There wouldn't be any manifold description, smooth differentiable manifold description of space-time at all. And a puny little local action, so remember the action has to do the job of suppressing all these hugely many non-manifold-like causal sets. A puny local action can't hope, growing like just like the number of elements, can't hope to overcome such an enormous entropic weight. However, causal sets are non-local, and this non-locality gives us hope that the action can overcome this entropy. And this hope has support from a class of models which are classical stochastic models for growing causal sets due to Rideout and Sorkin. They're called classical sequential growth models. And in those models, the KR, you can prove that the KR orders almost surely do not occur. So they have probability zero in these models. So simple physically motivated dynamical rules can actually suppress these hugely most numerous KR orders. Okay, so obviously in this sum over histories for causal sets, we would like to know what the weight is here, so e to the is. So what is the action of a causal set? And now we have some proposals for causal set actions. So the first ones that were written down were in 2 and 4 dimensions. And they, in 2 dimensions, so this is a 2-dimensional action of a causal set. And n, it's a linear combination of these numbers, n1, n2, and n3. And so is the 4-dimensional one, but instead of just being up to n3, you need to go to n4. What are these numbers? So n is just the cardinality of the causal set, it's just the number of elements. Ni is the number of order intervals of cardinality I plus 1. So let's take n1 for an example. That's the number of order intervals of cardinality 2. So it's an order interval with 2 elements. An order interval is a subset of the causal set which has 1 minimal element and 1 maximal element and contains all the elements which are causally which are in between them in the order. So a order interval of cardinality 2 just has a minimal element and a maximal element. It must be a link. So the links... So this is a causal set. I've drawn the Hasse diagram. The links are just these edges. So n1 is you just count the number of edges here. So n is the number of elements. N1 is the number of links. N2 is the number of 3-element order intervals. So that's an order interval in which there's a minimal element, a maximal element, and 1 element in between. So it's a 3-chain. So you count the number of 3 chains. So A could be the minimal element. E could be the maximal element. And D is the only element in between them. So AE is ADE is a 3-element order interval. And you count all such order intervals, and that's N2. N3 is the number of 4-element order intervals. And there's a 4-element order interval here that's the minimal element is B, the maximum element is E, and there are these 2 elements, D and C, in the causal order between them. So this is a 4-element order interval. And so is G, F, E, D. So you count the number of 4-element order intervals. and that's N3. You count the number of 5 element order intervals, that's N4, etc. So these causal set actions, I don't have time to explain to you where they came from. I can certainly tell you about that if you're interested afterwards. But they're very reminiscent of the Reggie action. They're linear combinations of numbers of small sub entities of your discrete manifold. So that you have the number of elements, the number of, you can easily imagine that links are sort of like edges. But then you have to identify faces with these 3 element order intervals. Okay. Now there are causal set actions in all other dimensions. Now this is finally proved by Glaser and Phillips. And we have reason to believe that the average over sprinklings into some Lorentzian manifold. So take a Lorentzian manifold, sprinkle into it, calculate this Lorentzian manifold of finite space-time volume, sprinkle into it, create a causal set, and calculate its, let's say its two-dimensional causal set action. Then we have reason to believe that in the continuum limit, as you take the density of your sprinkling to infinity, so you sprinkle at higher and higher density, the average over sprinklings of the action tends to the Einstein-Hilbert action plus a boundary term. I've written out what it would mean in 4 dimensions, but the conjecture holds in all dimensions. So this is the Einstein-Hilbert term. And the boundary term is the area of the corner of the space-time. I should have mentioned that this space-time has to be globally hyperbolic. So it's a finite volume, globally hyperbolic space-time. This term here, A, is the two-dimensional area of the corner of the space-time. So for example, if the region that you're sprinkling into is a causal interval in 4 dimensions, so that's just a sort of double cone, this corner is the two-sphere on the equator of the double cone. If the in 2 dimensions, if the region is an order interval, it's just a causal diamond, the corner are just exactly the 2 corners. So in 4 dimensions, this is the conjecture for the boundary term. In 2 dimensions, the area or volume of this corner is just a constant, because it's just 2, right? It's just the number of corners. Okay, so that's the conjecture. And you can see that I'm going to give you some evidence now that supports this conjecture. And you can see that in 2 and 4 dimensions, if you're sprinkling into a flat region of space-time, then the bulk term vanishes, and you should get in 2 dimensions just a number, and you should get in 4 dimensions something which scales like the area of this two-sphere corner. Okay, so what about, so let's look at the two-dimensional case. So the conjecture about the mean of the two-dimensional action becomes that the average over sprinklings of this linear combination of these numbers should tend to a constant in the infinite density limit for the sprinklings. And we can prove this, actually, analytically in 2 dimensions. And this limit, this constant here, is just 1. Four regions with 2 corners like a causal interval. So here's a causal interval. You sprinkle into it, and you let calculate the two-dimensional action, calculate this quantity, take the average over sprinklings, and then take the limit of infinite density, then you get 1 for any causal diamond. And it's equal to 0 for regions like the section of a cylinder, so that you can see there are no corners. This is corner-free. So the conjecture is that this should give you 0, and in fact it does. So first I'll point out how good the cancellation has to be in order for this to happen. When you're doing your, say you sprinkle a million, you have a causal set of a million elements, n is a million, n1 grows like n to the 3/2, so that's a trillion. And I think these grow like, these are also of order trillions. So you've got trillion numbers which are in the trillions, and they're cancelling so beautifully to give you something which is just not growing at all. It's just a constant. And clearly, there's something topological going on here, but intriguingly, it turns out not to be the topological that you expect in two-dimensional gravity. It's not the Gauss-Bonnet theorem. So what is it? So there's something non-local and something topological here. So here's an interval. The causal set action, the mean of it, is 1. But I can divide that causal set action into a number, that interval into a number of subintervals. And the causal set action of each of those subintervals is also 1. So it looks like that's a contradiction. You get 1 for the causal set action, for the mean, for the whole interval, and 1 for each of the subintervals, but 1's not equal to 9. However, the action, the causal set action, is non-local. It's not additive. The action for the whole interval is not the sum of the actions for the subintervals. The non-locality means that there are contributions that come from in particular, each edge here, and the contribution you can prove is -1, roughly, -1 in the limit. And each vertex, so the vertex, for example, between interval 1 and interval 5, contributes +1. So in fact, we have that the action for the total large interval is the sum of the actions for the individual intervals, which is F, the number of faces, if you like, minus E, which is the number of edges, plus V, the number of vertices, and that's just the Euler character, which for the disk is indeed 1. Okay. So there's something nicely topological about this, and also non-local, because the action is not additive. Now, we need to do more work on the conjecture in the curved case, but we have a complete understanding of the causal set, two-dimensional causal set action in two-dimensional flat space. Okay, what about higher dimensions, higher dimensional actions? Well, Dionigi Benincasa has done simulations of sprinklings into three- and four-dimensional flat space. And there, remember that we want the action, in three dimensions, we want the action to grow like the, now it's just the length of this boundary, it's just a circle. And in four dimensions, we want it to grow like the area of this two-sphere boundary. So in three dimensions, we want it to grow like the number of elements to the power 1/3, and in four dimensions, we want it to grow like the number of elements to the power 1/2. So here's the data. We fit the data to some number, some coefficient, times n to the some power for d equals 3 and 4. Here are the plots. I'm sorry, you probably can't see that too well. And do a fit to this, and the fit is not terrible, but it's not exactly what one would want. So for three dimensions, we want this to be a third. It's 0.43. For four dimensions, we want it to be half. It's 0.56. One can always kind of escape bad conclusions by saying, well, we just haven't reached the asymptotic regime yet. And I think actually in this case, it's true. So ignore these error bars. They're kind of meaningless because I think we just haven't reached we haven't been able to sprinkle large enough causal sets to reach the asymptotic regime yet. So we need to do more simulations. And especially for curved space-time. But the indications are reasonable, and again, I want to emphasize that the cancellations that are happening are really, really very good, because the numbers that have to cancel are huge, and they have to cancel in such a way as to give exactly the right asymptotic behavior. All right, this non-locality of the action is welcome. So we'd like the action to suppress the non-manifold-like causal sets. So what about the worst ones, the KR orders? Well, for the KR orders, the causal set action is not local, and indeed it grows like n squared, the number of elements squared. So there's a chance, there's sort of a hope, there's something to pin your hopes on that this causal set action can actually suppress the KR orders because it's non-local. So there's a slapdash argument that this path sum over two-layer orders, so two-layer orders are sort of like KR orders but just have two layers instead of three, there's this slapdash argument due to Riedijs and Sorkin that when you do this sum over over two-layer orders of e to the is, that will actually be zero, or very close to zero. So I'm running out of time, so I'm not going to give you this slapdash argument. I can show you later. And then the an argument is that most KR for most KR orders, they are, as far as the action is concerned, very much like two-level orders because they only have links. There are very few three-element order intervals in a KR order. Okay. We have to do better than just these slapdash arguments. One way to do better is to do Monte Carlo simulations. And this whole idea and approach is being pioneered by Sumati Surya. And we could try as a warm-up for calculating the sum over all causal sets, a Wick-rotated sum over 2D orders. So those are causal sets which can be embedded into two dimensions. And to do that, obviously, you need to do everything you need from Monte Carlo simulations. We need a set of local moves, and this is a picture to whet your appetite for Sumati's talk this afternoon. Okay, I feel like we've kind of grown up in causal set theory that we're now able to show diagrams like this. Okay, so let me summarize since I've got minus 30 seconds. Causal sets unify manifold and metric. They're austere. There's only combinatorial information in a causal set. They're somehow the simplest thing you could possibly imagine. You only need to be able to count in order to define a causal set. You don't need to construct the real numbers or anything like that to define a causal set. A causal set is made of bits. There is Lorentz invariant atomicity. Causal sets are Lorentz invariant and atomic. And they're a counterexample to the claim that discreteness must violate Lorentz symmetry. The non-locality of causal sets gives us hope that action can overcome entropy. We've proposed a class of non-local actions, which are conjectured to average the Einstein-Hilbert action plus a corner boundary term. That more needs to be done to work out to find evidence for this proposal. And we ask the overall question, do these actions really do the job of suppressing the non-manifold-like causal sets? So again, see Sumati's talk this afternoon. I'll end there. Thank you.
Right. Time for a couple questions.
So you led us looking for excess bag, and the question is: usually, when physics has to do this job, the starting point is to assess the present situation. What is the excess bag in the present situation? What are the points of conflict that we have to remove? So, in this assumption of path integral for quantum mechanics and causal order in generality, how do you see it linked to our present assessment of the conceptual structure of the quantum gravity problem? So, are those two particularly solid ingredients, and others must go, or?
We can identify some excess baggage. So the continuum is excess baggage according to this hypothesis. I mean, to me, the three things of path integral, causal structure, and atomicity, they go together. I mean, I would find it hard overall to make an argument for each one in isolation of the other ones. I mean, eventually, the fundamental theory has to stand on its own feet as something which has its own inner motivation from itself. I mean, the way that we get to it, I think, is via this kind of process where you look carefully at what you have and you try to identify things which seem most fundamental, and then you have to add some new ingredient. In this case, it's this kinematical atomicity. But and different people will do that in different ways. Obviously, we have a diverse set of views about what we should keep, what will survive in the deep theory. But eventually, the program has to stand on its own. It has to be a theory which can be justified in its own terms. And for me, causal, this bare bones causal set framework has that quality. It's something which, to me, is attractive in and of itself as something which one could found physics upon. I'm not sure that answered your question, really.
I have a question about the path integral part. Mm-hmm. So suppose you you don't want to do the path integral, but let's say you take the local version of path integral, something like the Schringer variational principle, Schringer-Feynman variational principle. That's covariant. You got your action, right? And you could, in principle, put any observable you want. You know, 1 point, 2 point, 3 point, infinite number of correlators if you want. But it's kind of polynomial in H bar. Right, when you write the Schringer action principle, the variation of action is IH bar times variation of whatever observable you take. Would that be easier for your continuum limit? Because in this case, when you take the path integral, you have all these 1 over H bar things to worry about, cancellation of phases and so forth. But if you took the variational, Schringer variational thing, yes, you have many observables to check, but it's polynomial in H bar. Wouldn't that be easier for the continuum limit? Have you thought about that?
I haven't thought about that. So maybe you can explain to me more about what you mean by that. So yeah, I'd like to hear about that.
We have 1 minute. A very short question about jobs of suppressing. Have you tried fermions? Because the Pauli principle is very strong. It's not puny. It's a very strong principle. Could be also related to the question of how would matter enter into the picture?
Well, those are all very good questions. So we would love to be able to put fermions on a causal set. So far, we haven't managed to do that because by the spin statistics theorem, fermions should be also spinorial. And at the moment, we don't know how to put spinorial objects on a causal set. However, there are ideas and not really concretely worked out and rather heuristic right now to employ some kind of fermionicity in performing this path sum. So, for example, in the KR and the sequential growth models that I mentioned of Sorkin and Rideout, the very simplest sequential growth model is one in which each causal set element that is each new causal set element is causally related to an existing one just with some fixed probability. So there's just one parameter in the model. So that model is called transitive percolation. In that, when you calculate the probability of a particular causal set in transitive percolation, it's multiplied by a weight factor, which is the number of natural labelings of this causal set. So one could imagine changing that weight factor to be more fermionic. So in the sense that if one labeling is related to another labeling by an odd permutation of individual labels, then it comes in with a relative minus sign. That could, in fact, maybe we even know, I'm trying to remember now, but maybe we even know that that actually does quite a good job of suppressing some things that we might not like. So, yeah, those ideas are certainly, very, very good ones, and maybe very helpful.